You are listening to The Weekly, a co-production of WOBC and The Oberlin Review. I'm your host, Johan Cavert, and I'm joined by my co-host and the managing editor of The Oberlin Review, Daniel Marcus.
Good to be back.
Oberlin has a reputation for being a green college and a leading institution nationally on environmental issues. We're pleased to be talking on the show about sustainability at Oberlin, and we have two distinguished guests joining us. Bridget Flynn is the sustainability manager in the Office of Environmental Sustainability, and Rachel Hood is a student activist and leader on campus sustainability issues. We are so thankful for the work you do, and we're pleased to have you.
Thanks for having us.
So just to get into it, first thing I'm thinking about is sort of if you'd mind giving us a little background just about both of your roles that you play on campus, what you do, and sort of how you became involved with sustainability work.
You want to go first or do you want me to?
I can go first. So I work for the resource conservation team on campus, which is like a team of 10 students. And we work with facilities and also with Bridget in the Office of Environmental Sustainability. And I'm also in Students for Energy Justice, which is a student organization on campus, and we do a lot of organizing around the Nexus Pipeline. And I'm on the Eco-Olympics Committee, and I did a winter term project with Bridget this year about sustainability at Oberlin. So all of those things have been within this year, and that's, I don't know, I showed up and I was like, I want to do more.
And this is Bridget, and I, as you said, am the sustainability manager. So I've been here since July of 2012, so I'm about coming up on 6 years now, which is still like wild to me. And when I got my role at Oberlin, I was a fellow. I was only supposed to be here for 2 years and then leave, and have been here ever since. So my role has evolved quite a bit since I've been here, but some of the things I'm doing now is I manage our internship program. So I have usually about 10 students working in completely unique roles related to sustainability. So we have things ranging from like transportation to finance to greenhouse gas inventorying, like more economics and all different kinds of roles, organizing and event planning, Eco-Olympics. And I also now manage the resource conservation team that Rachel is on. I administer the Committee on Environmental Sustainability with the faculty committee that Johan is the student senate appointee to. So I work on essentially a range of sustainability issues from policy to recycling, transportation, and mostly my focus is on behavior and engagement around sustainability. So the adoption of more sustainable behaviors and getting connecting students to opportunities around sustainability and supporting our institution's commitments.
How did your sort of position evolve from where it started to what it is now? Can you just take us through that?
Sure. So, well, I'll also mention before I came to Oberlin, so I was interested in high school, but I just kind of thought that like it seemed so obvious that people should be interested in kind of environmental issues because we live on this planet and it's the only one we have right now, and presumably into some amount of the future. So it just seemed pretty obvious. And then when I think I learned that there was so much bad stuff going on, I thought, oh, well, that seems like maybe something I could do. And then I went to Indiana University in Bloomington, and I actually created my own major in environmental ethics. So I studied questions on how people relate to the environment and the natural world, as well as other beings that inhabit it. So I started asking some questions about like social justice and animal rights as well. And then I started working at the sustainability office there. I was doing vegan community organizing in Indianapolis. I worked at a wind energy company in Chicago briefly, and then I saw the job at Oberlin, and I was like, oh my God, this is so perfect for me. And somehow out of hundreds of applicants across the country, I got it, and it has been a great position ever since. So when I got here, like I said, I was hired by our director of sustainability, and he left 6 months into my job. So then it was just me in our office for over a year. So I think that's when I got my first promotion to sustainability coordinator. And then finally we hired Megan Reister, who's our AVP, Assistant Vice President of Campus Energy and Sustainability, and then she went on a maternity leave shortly after she got here, and then went on a maternity leave again. So it was for a long time just really me, but now we have an awesome team of three people, Megan, and then Daryl Tremaine and myself, in our office. So we're an office of three, and we've been around since 2006. So it actually has been a little while, but I've been our longest running member of the office, which I'm only barely 30, so that's kind of wild, but
that's great. Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that. Would you mind sort of giving us a rough overview of where Oberlin is at in terms of like sustainability issues generally, and just sort of like in relation maybe also to other peer institutions or things like that? I know that's a broad question.
Yeah, maybe we'll get into it with some of our specific programs more too, but I think in a lot of ways we're still leading and trying to do a lot of really cool things, but in other ways I think sustainability is something that almost every institution in the 21st century is trying to adopt. So I think we definitely need a lot more that we need to continue to do. We've also made some really bold commitments that I'm sure we'll talk about, and we'll have to get make further progress on. But I mean, what do you think?
I think Oberlin historically has been a leader in sustainability for peer institutions because we were the first institution to do a lot of things, but I think now it's really interesting watching Oberlin try to think of new things to do while all the other peer institutions are now really focusing on sustainability. And I think it's sort of changing a lot of the conversations in Oberlin sustainability, which is really interesting to watch as a student.
What are some of those firsts that Oberlin achieved that you are maybe referring to?
Sure. So we were one of our the first schools in the country. We were a charter signatory to the American College and Universities President's Climate Commitment, which used to be called the ACUPCC. And then they were like, wow, that's a really long name. So now it's just called the Carbon Commitment. But it was really the first kind of commitment of its kind, essentially asking institutions to take action on climate change. So we were one of the first institutions to sign that, and the first of our peers to sign that commitment.
Do you know, roughly when?
2006. Okay. So the Committee on Environmental Sustainability and the Office of Environmental Sustainability were established subsequently to signing that commitment and trying to take real leadership on this issue. So I think that's one of them. We stopped selling bottled water in 1999. I mean, if you want to trace our history back to all of our buildings being on Tappan Square and then creating a green space in campus, I mean, that was almost, 100 years ago? So I think there's been quite a legacy of environmental kind of interest and activism in Oberlin that typically goes alongside all kinds of other progressive social issues because we all rely on our natural environment. So it's not just, to me, not about just protecting the natural world as something that's separate from us, but about trying to integrate environmental issues alongside, you know, what humans care about and the economies that we organize ourselves around. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of things that Oberlin has been, that we were kind of the cutting edge on a lot of things. And it is funny, as Rachel said, now to see when people catch up to us that now, like, there are things that people see us as doing really well that personally I don't think we're doing very well, but we did it first. So our recycling on campus could be way better, or, you know, different things that we were kind of one of the first institutions to do certain types of things like the dashboard or, you know, all kinds of really interesting and innovative things. But we also have way more issues because we couldn't learn from the template that many other people had to learn from. So it's cool that we've made a broader impact, but that also doesn't mean that we're without our own challenges here.
Yeah. Rachel, would you mind sort of giving a rough overview of what the sort of sustainability work from a student perspective is like, what the different groups are on campus and how they work together, like what issues they're focusing on?
Yeah.
I know that's also a broad question.
Yeah, there's a lot, and I can speak to some of them for sure. So the resource conservation team is, like I said, a group of 10 students, and we work with facilities to maintain a lot of the programs that already exist. So we have a recycling subgroup that works on like ink cartridge recycling and some of the harder to recycle materials and bringing them to places that can be recycled. We have a food rescue team, which is part of like the Bon Appetit commitment to sustainability, is that food is rescued. So we like physically take the food from the dining halls and bring it to Oberlin Community Services. We have a community garden at J House. And also something I think that the Office of Environmental Sustainability relies on the RCT with is sort of community programming and trying to bridge the gap between college and community a little bit with things like the garden and food rescue. So that's the RCT. Students for Energy Justice, also known as SEDJ, is a completely student-run group, and we have been organizing a lot around the Nexus Pipeline in Ohio, but we also work on sort of bringing speakers with climate justice and things like that. Eco-Olympics is the campus-wide competition that happens, used to be in the spring, but now it's in the fall every year. And the students on that committee have a lot to do with the planning of the events and also working on how to get students engaged. I think something that's really interesting about sustainability at Oberlin is that groups don't talk to each other, which is something that we ran into last year during Eco-Olympics, is there was this meeting of all the different sustainability groups on campus, and they realized that like three different student groups were trying to put together food rescue at the exact same time and had no idea that the other groups existed. So I think that's one thing that I personally, and like the groups that I'm in, have been trying to work on, especially because there seems to be a lot more overlap recently about students who are in different groups. Like there are several people who are in Students for Energy Justice in the RCT or the Dashboard and Students for Energy Justice and things like that. But yeah, I think it's definitely something that's been kind of lacking, and I'm not entirely sure why. I think it maybe has to do with the fact that environmental groups on campus are kind of these like very small isolated groups of people, and it's, even though a lot of students care about those things, it's kind of hard to find other students that are directly engaging on it because like the programs are so isolated and very, although working on environmentalism, working on it in very different ways, so it can kind of seem like there isn't overlap when there should be.
And a lot of the groups are very specific, so at some schools, it's like, we're the sustainability club. Mm-hmm. And here it's like, we're working on this specific issue. We're working on this specific issue. And I think one of my, part of what my job is supposed to be is supposed to like help coordinate those things. But it's really hard because you want to respect student organizing and more just be an outlet for them to talk to each other and be more effective without like feeling like I'm overstepping. So we've tried to have some pretty productive conversations about how we can better support people communicating with each other, but we haven't quite found a solution yet. But as always, there's optimism for next year.
One thing you both have sort of alluded to is that Oberlin did a lot of things first and now is maybe not doing some of those things so well. Could you talk about what are some areas that you think we're not doing so well in and maybe why you think we're not? Like what the root cause of those sort of those failures, you could say, is?
Yeah, it's hard to think of a lot of the things that I think we're not leading on are more things that, like I said, we either did kind of first or everyone's sort of doing that we just don't put a lot of time into, you know, like recycling or transportation or certain things like that. And I think in other ways, things are always evolving, so we never actually tell our story of what is, like, what are the things that we're actually doing really well on? Because with sustainability, until we reach a more equitable and sustainable society, our work isn't done. So it's hard to sometimes, like, stop and celebrate stuff that we were doing really well because there's always so much still ahead of us. So, I mean, right now, almost 100% of our electricity is green. And do most people know that? I'm sure they don't. And so I think, you know, that's a huge accomplishment. Or, I mean, we switched from coal to natural gas in the central heating plant, and that helped cut our scope 1 emissions, which are kind of our stationary, or our, like, combustion that happens on campus. But it's still a fossil fuel, and it's still not the kind of progress that we want to see eventually. So, you know, I think a lot of people don't even know that we, you know, had truckloads and truckloads of coal coming to our campus and being burned on campus. I think there's just, we don't always communicate with students a lot of what is actually happening. I think sometimes we are really good at celebrating our successes. And I think a lot of that is thanks to David Orr, who just has the ability to speak things into existence. But I think with some of that being, you know, such a visionary, there are things that kind of probably make sense in his mind. And then those of us who are, you know, doing certain things, that there's a little bit of a disconnect. But I mean, we owe so much to him and his vision. And I think so much of what we've achieved is thanks to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the Adam Joseph Lewis Center, for example, a net positive building that hundreds of people come visit every single year. But when we first started it, he didn't really have any support for that building, and he was able to raise all of the money, but also we didn't have an operator to manage the building correctly. So it wasn't net positive for the first, you know, decade of its existence. And now it is, and it's running great, and people still really care about it, and still are coming to visit it, even though it was created in 2000 and occupied, you know, 2001. So that was, I mean, the age of the students coming in to this institution.
Would you mind, I know, sort of thinking about like the broader sustainability legacy, I guess is maybe one term for it, but just like where I know Oberlin has sort of like received recognition for like its successes in the past, if you would mind maybe talking a little bit about that, and then what like the next steps are, where you think the next like phase of the vision should be.
Sure. So I guess some of the progress that I alluded to was, you know, we switched from coal to natural gas. We did a bunch of lighting retrofits. We've done a lot of efficiency measures, and we've secured a lot of green electricity with the installation of the solar array and the purchase of more renewable electricity, working with OMLPS, which is our municipal utility. So we've done a lot of things already on campus. So since our baseline in 2007, we've about halved our carbon emissions. But I think the next step is the next half. And largely that's attributable to heating and cooling campus. But because a lot of our buildings don't have cooling, it's really heating campus, which is obviously a necessity in this climate. So we're using, you know, like I said, natural gas now, and the leading proposal that we've been talking about for the last year or so is trying to source waste heat from an electrification process at the landfill, which is only about 2 miles from campus. So it's a really unique and situation that we have a landfill so close. And not only that, but that it's a landfill that's creating a lot of green electricity and one of the largest in the country that is so close to us. So I think that would be really cool if we're able to get that to happen. But that's sort of our next phase, is trying to make progress on that. And I think we talked a little bit about the Oberlin community as well. So the college has a carbon neutrality goal of 2025. The city of Oberlin has a climate positivity goal of 2050. So we might be able to serve some community buildings off of that as well. So that would be really neat. And we really work with the Oberlin community quite a lot. I think one of the things that you might want me to mention is sort of the way that we work with the community, and how OES might be a little bit different than some of the other offices on campus. So we are in the finance and administration division of the college, and a lot of the people that, I mean, how many of you have been to the service building? Not that many people know actually where it is, but our involved cohort here is probably a little different than your average student. So a lot of a lot of our peers in the Finance Administration Division maybe work with a couple students, but we really get to work with a lot of students, and we really get to work with the Oberlin community quite a bit. So both in, you know, event planning and things that we're doing, you know, we've hosted events in community spaces, we interact with the community. Personally, I served on a commission at the city level before. Mm-hmm. I worked with city council to pass a resolution for complete streets in Oberlin. And we're also, a few of us, meaning a few college employees, are also on the committee working on the climate action plan at the city. I have pretty regular conversations with people in city council and with public works and our electric director. So we really communicate actually pretty frequently. So I think that's also kind of unique. And some of the stuff that we're doing around resilience, I think, is some of the most exciting things that are happening right now. So maybe I'll say just a couple words about resilience. So so we signed the carbon commitment in 2006. And then at the end of 2015, President Kurzweil, right before he left, signed the resilience commitment, which is a different commitment that's pretty similar, that basically says we need to work with our local communities to increase our resilience in the face of a changing climate. So it's not enough to just become carbon neutral if we're doing that in isolation in our, you know, institutions, but we need to both work with our community, but also we need to adapt to a changing climate, mm-hmm. because climate change is already happening. So part of the resilience planning has been establishing a campus community task force. So I get to work with all different kinds of people in the community. That's been so exciting, and kind of going beyond typical emergency preparedness to talk about different scenarios and how we could share assets and like what's important to this community and how we can kind of strengthen our bonds so that we can become more resilient together. And that's been really, really cool and exciting. And I'm not even sure what your original question was.
That's great. Rachel, I want to go to you for a second. There's obviously, it's one thing to work in student organizations where everyone around you is like-minded, and it's another thing to work with Bridget, who's, you know, whose full-time job is to do this. I'm curious what your thoughts are on interactions with the student population as a whole, and sort of how the student population as a whole responds to sustainability, whether or not it's positive or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think interacting with the student population as a whole is both like disheartening and also can be encouraging if you actually get to have like a in-depth conversation with the student population. I think it's really easy to write off students as being apathetic to environmental stuff at this point, which I understand, but I don't really agree with. I think it's more that, especially with the political climate right now and sort of the fact that a lot of people at Oberlin feel like their like personal safety is really at risk right now, I just think that they're more concerned with other things that are like obviously pressing in this moment, like racial justice and undocumented immigrants and things like that. I think something that I've heard a lot is the fact that Oberlin environmentalism at times can seem very white and seem kind of privileged, which I understand and I don't necessarily agree with because of all the things that I know about Oberlin environmentalism, but I'm not sure that all of those things are like well communicated to the student body. But I think that something we've been working on a lot is to try to connect environmentalism to climate justice and therefore to just social justice overall, which I think in making those connections, students remember why they care about the environment and remember, like, you know, when they came to Oberlin and heard about Oberlin's history of environmentalism, they're like, yes, this is the place I want to be because this is really important. And I don't think that people don't think that that's important. I think they're just, I also think that it's kind of a hopeless time a little bit in our nation for the environment. And I think that's definitely been carried into Oberlin with people feeling, and I also think that Oberlin students recognize that like changing your shower from 7 minutes to 5 minutes isn't going to solve the world's problems. And like, if you throw away a piece of plastic, that isn't going to, that's not the tipping point. And I think that they recognize that. And so aren't super interested in these like face value, like here's three things you can do to help save the world, because I think they recognize that that's not going to save the world. But I think that Oberlin is all about intersectionality, and the intersectionality of climate justice is so pervasive in all of the other issues that people at Oberlin care about. I think it's more something that those of us who really care about sustainability need to be making more obvious, and need to be making more accessible to students whose priority isn't sustainability. Yeah, I think about this all the time.
Do you think that, because I agree, one thing that people talk about a lot is, you know, oh, shortening my shower from 7 minutes to 5 minutes doesn't do anything. Do you think that that sort of mindset is in a way harmful? Not necessarily because it actually makes that substantive of a difference, but because of the like headspace that people get in because of it?
Yeah. I think that, you know, shortening your shower from 7 minutes to 5 minutes actually does make a difference in the terms of the like ideology that you prescribe to and the way that you choose to view your consumption. I think that not making that connection between the physical, like changing the time of your shower too, like I'm thinking about my consumption consciously. I'm thinking about how I use water here affects people who are in places where there's water shortages. So I think that that mindset can be harmful. It's very understandable. And I think that it's kind of our job to make sure that that connection is made. But like we've been talking about Eco Olympics a lot and how we want to make the connection more to climate justice and to other forms of justice, and showing that like all of these little things can actually make a difference if everybody is doing them and everybody's creating a world in which people are really consciously thinking about what they're doing and how they're affecting both the environment around them and other people who rely on that environment. And I think you should, like, the conversation needs to be kept around why it's important to recycle paper or to buy LED lights. Because all of those little things do matter in that you're consciously thinking about your effect on the world and your effect in the environment, which is kind of ultimately what sustainability comes down to.
I'm just sitting here nodding.
One thing I'm curious about is, and maybe you have more, I don't know who would be able to speak to this, but just sort of thinking about like environmentalism and activism within like the broader national context, and maybe how that's different on a college campus, especially when you have sort of flows of students coming in. Do you have thoughts about how that impacts, you know, what gets accomplished and just sort of like the culture of activism at Oberlin?
Mm. I could say a lot about that. yeah, I mean, I think a few months ago, when City Council was voting on whether or not to accept the settlement from Nexus, I think, so Students for Energy Justice organized around that a lot and brought a lot of students out, and I think we definitely got a lot of criticism about the fact that students are transient in the community, and I, like, 100% understand every single perspective on that issue, and I understand where people are coming from. I think my take on student activism is that if you're existing in a community, you should try to exist in a way that has a positive effect. And I don't think that that necessarily always means making every single person in the community happy with what you're saying. I also think it's interesting that this idea that there is one community anywhere. I mean, the Oberlin, you know, the city of Oberlin is incredibly diverse and everybody has their own opinion on every single thing. So to say that, like, the community thinks this thing isn't, that doesn't really exist. I think activism can be really challenging because students are transient. I think it can also be really powerful in that students can bring resources and particular skills that maybe a community doesn't have access to. For example, with Students for Energy Justice, we work a lot in Lorain and Medina counties right now. And like all the time we hear people say, I need help with technology. Like I have no sense of what to do with technology. And I think that's a resource that students can bring. And I think something is like, oh, we're doing this event and we just need bodies in the room. I think students can bring that in. So I think it's with activism, it comes down to a lot of like, what as a student can I bring to this movement that already exists? And like, how can I maybe add a facet to that movement? So for us, it's the facet of climate justice and getting people who are upset about the pipeline to also think about the fact that, think about it in like broader terms of racial and social justice. Yeah, I think it's a conversation that's like pretty difficult and is always like, is always a continuing conversation around activism. But I understand how student activism can be detrimental, but I also think it can be really beneficial when it's done consciously.
Yeah. I think that's a really good transition sort of into thinking about the Nexus pipeline, like you talked about it, but would you mind just sort of breaking down what that is for people who haven't, you know, maybe heard of it or don't really know the basics? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
For sure. So the Nexus pipeline is a pipeline that is being constructed through Ohio and Michigan, and it ultimately ends up in Canada. And what it is it's an export pipeline for natural gas. So it's huge, it's 3 feet in diameter. And they're basically moving fracked natural gas from the shale fields in Southeast Ohio through Ohio and Michigan up to Canada to be exported and sold around the country, around the world. And it's incredibly detrimental and disturbing, quite frankly. I was in Medina a little bit ago, and I was looking at some of the construction sites, and to think about those pipelines existing in communities without any access to like safety resources, even like that in itself, like disregarding these issues of climate change and like environmental justice, just thinking about the fact that this giant pipeline exists in a community and the community is receiving no support on what to do if it explodes, what to do if it leaks. The fact that compressor stations are emitting tons of toxins and these communities are basically just sentenced to cancer and disease and loss of agricultural production, which is what a lot of these places rely on, is just like really heartbreaking. But that's what the Nexus pipeline is, in my very unbiased opinion.
One thing that I think comes up in the national conversation a lot, which I think doesn't necessarily play into the debate that much in Oberlin, because many of us share similar views, perhaps as evidenced by the really high student turnout to press for a vote against the settlement. One argument that's made a lot is, well, the pipeline is going to get built no matter what. It's going to end up somewhere. Do you, in general, have feelings about that? Because, you know, if let's say that, you know, Oberlin said no to the settlement, the pipeline gets routed somewhere else now. And then, you know, there is, it's not our community and we did good by defending our own, but it's not, you know, some community ends up with it. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. I'm not asking you to have a rebuttal because it's a really thick sort of murky argument to get into, but I would just be really interested to hear maybe both of your thoughts if you have them.
Yeah. I think that's a really hard conversation. So Students for Energy Justice, we come from this perspective of climate justice, which is to say we don't want this in our community and we don't want it in any community. And we recognize that if it's not in our community, it's going to be in a poorer and more diverse community, because that's where like environmental destruction ends up happening a lot of the time. I think specific to the vote at city council, that vote, whether or not the city accepted the settlement, wasn't going to change the route at all, which is, I think, in part why we felt justified in saying that we should vote no. I think, actually, so the city council president, or yeah, I mm-hmm. think President Brian Burgess yep. said in the meeting, you know, it's really easy to say you want to take the moral high ground and not accept this settlement. But you have to think about the fact that, like, this is coming through our community and we need to protect our community. And a student sort of responded directly to that in her public testimony. She said, Oberlin is a really privileged community, and I think we always talk about using our privilege wisely, which means when other communities can't take the moral high ground and make this moral stance of not accepting a settlement, it's our responsibility to do that. Which I thought was a really, like, excellent argument to that point. I don't want to see pipelines anywhere, and I don't want to see it rerouted out of Oberlin just to go somewhere else. But I understand that that was on the table for a really long time, and I think that I understand why people fought to get it out of their community, because, I mean, at the end of the day, you want to protect you and the people you love first. But I think there is some confusion about the fact that we don't want to see the pipeline anywhere, not just not in Oberlin. Yeah, and I think constantly reminding people of the fact that these pipelines and other, you know, mining projects or whatever often get put in communities that are poor and cannot and rural and can't, like, don't have anyone to fight for them, I think is really, really important. And I think why the fight in Oberlin is so critical is because we have the resources to fight it. We have the political engagement to fight it. And, like, we have the education to understand a lot of these things that a lot of people don't have any help in understanding, and they're really complicated processes and really difficult to comprehend. And you have surveyors going onto people's land and talking in all this legal jargon and then handing over a paper to sign, and people don't even know what they're signing over, but they do it because no one is there to tell them that they don't have to do it. Yeah, so I think it's basically just, like, keeping it centered around those national conversations, even though it doesn't necessarily pertain to Oberlin, is still really important, especially when we're working with other organizers in the community, like specifically in Medina County. Yeah.
So then where do we go from here, at least on the nexus issue, right? If the pipeline route's not changing and we didn't accept the settlement, is the plan now to build in a really robust set of response procedures in the case that something does go wrong, if and when, or, like, what is the plan for Oberlin from here?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of different things from my understanding that can be done. There is the like setting up monitoring procedures and setting up safety plans for if and when a leak or an explosion happens. And that's something we have been working on in Students for Energy Justice. We've been bringing a water monitoring training to some places around the area. We've done it the past couple weekends. And we've also been working with some organizers from Friends for Environmental Justice and a couple of other things to try to get in contact with landowners and give them resources for emergency planning and things like that. I think another sort of next step is to look at maybe more visible resistance, whether that's in the form of protests or a variety of different kinds of actions that you could take with that, and trying to, even if, I think something that people say is, oh, well, this pipeline is coming no matter what, and I just kind of want to give up. And I personally think that it's the worst thing that you can do and exactly what they want you to do. I think constantly returning the conversation to the issues that are happening and gaining visibility for that, even if it seems like it's fruitless, it really isn't. I'm from Virginia, and I've worked on pipelines in Virginia before, and right now in Virginia, there are a bunch of people camped in trees, like physically preventing the cutting down of those trees and the construction of the pipeline. And now Tim Kaine, who is one of our senators, is saying, we need to look at how these permits were given, because it really doesn't seem like they were given in the right way. So even if it seems like, oh, all the permits are there, it's happening, it really isn't until the gas is flowing through the pipeline. And I'm really encouraged every time I see even like a no nexus sign in someone's yard, because it means that, like, we're not going to ignore the fact that this is happening. And we're going to keep pressure on, essentially. Yeah.
That's good. That's great to hear. That's very cool. Bridget, do you know, have there been other, I think, like, this is so interesting because it really gets to sort of like the heart of like broader environmental mm-hmm. concerns, and really thinking about how like communities broadly engage with these issues when they, you know, affect so many people and so many, you know, different groups and things like that. And it's not necessarily just contained in Oberlin. Have there been other, and, you know, I like, maybe this is unique, but have there been other things that students have engaged with in the past, sort of locally or more nationally, having to do with environmental issues like this?
I think a lot. I mean, students have gotten buses to go to national protests. I mean, there was a large demonstration at a Board of Trustees dinner when we were switching from coal to natural gas, in the central heating plant. I actually looked through the archives back when we were doing the From Coal to Carbon Neutrality campaign to look at what students were saying previously, and I think there's always been a pretty large and vocal opposition to environmental degradation for mm-hmm. quite a long time. I think with this issue specifically, as Rachel was talking, I was thinking through sort of the short and long term of things. You know, like, we have a landfill right next to us in the community. No one wants a landfill next to them. No one wants a pipeline next to them. But everyone wants to be able to throw stuff away, and they want mm-hmm. to be able to buy as much stuff as they want, because that's American freedom. And we want to be able to heat our showers and our homes and live independently and all these different things. So, what do we do, right? And I think that's why a lot of the work that we're doing around, you know, carbon neutrality and resilience is so important, is because it isn't just about what's happening here in Oberlin. Like, the fact that we have a large solar array the size of Tappan Square in Northeast Ohio, where we're, what, one of the cloudiest places in the United States, yet we've been able to economically work that out, I think really demonstrates that a lot of other places can be adding solar or wind. They could be doing ground source heat pumps. I mean, these things can happen. You just have to have kind of the know-how and the will to do it, because it is usually in the long term a better way to go. And I think, you know, when these issues become more real to people, that's when we have to start thinking about, okay, well, what kind of short-term gain are we getting from, you know, having a natural gas pipeline in Northeast Ohio? And what kind of long-term and short-term consequences are there to these kind of actions? And I think, you know, the NIMBY issues are really important. Like, no one wants these things near them, but we all want the benefits of them. And we're so disconnected to almost everything now, our food production, our electricity production. I mean, most people don't see what it takes to have a computer and to have a cell phone in your hand, and what happens to your trash when you're done with it, what happens to your electronics. We just want to consume mindlessly. And, you know, these kind of issues bring to light that we can't just do that. And I think that's why it's important to, for us as an institution and as a community and as, you know, a country and society, to recognize that we want to do better. And just because we might not be dealing with the consequences of things, some place and somewhere probably is. So what can we do to try better? And maybe we should funnel some money into a better way of thinking and being. 'Cause I'm a believer that all of our humanity is intertwined, and I think that we can be doing better. And I think, you know, some things are harder than others. But, I mean, yeah, if you just look at the stuff that we're trying to do here, it really is pretty heartening to me that, you know, we figured out some things and other places can too. Like, mm-hmm. we're just a small community in Ohio, but people want to know how we're doing, what we're doing. And I think that's why it's important to keep going.
I want to shift the topic of conversation to something perhaps a little bit more lighthearted right now, which is, I lived in Conn Hall my freshman year, mm-hmm. And ever since then, there have been pervasive questions about what the heck is going on with the Conn Hall roof. So let's set the record straight right now. What is the deal with the panels on the Conn Hall roof?
Sure. So half of them are actual panels now. Yes.
Right.
So I was not here when Conn was built, but my understanding is that they thought, of course, we're going to have solar energy on the, you know, LEED Silver certified sustainability dorm. But at the last minute, it was value engineered out, which was basically that we don't want to spend the money. So we're just going to put faux panels and the racking for solar on there, but not put it on right now. And maybe there was some kind of argument about the cost of solar, and if we just wait a couple more years, it'll be probably cost half of what it would have in, you know, 2009, and that probably was true. But I also think that a lot of students were pretty mad that there were just fake panels up there. So the Green Edge Fund took the leadership to say, let's put actual photovoltaic on Conn, and they did. So half of it is does have a PV array, and there are a couple of the racks that are actually racked and wired for solar thermal. So hopefully that can be a next thing that we could do, because we don't have any solar thermal on campus, so that would be kind of neat. We have a decent amount of PV now, but I think it'd be pretty cool to have some solar thermal, so hopefully that can be a next.
Yeah. What in the grand scheme of things, sort of where is Oberlin at in terms of reaching that carbon neutrality goal? Mm-hmm. Like what percentage, comes like from solar panels, like in Northfield and things like that? Do you have a rough?
Yeah, I'll give you some basic figures. So, one thing to differentiate is there's electricity and then there's heating. So when we talk about powering something, we're talking about electricity. And our electricity is almost 100% renewable, thanks to working with the city of Oberlin and installing our own arrays on campus, where the college is nearly 100%. Our heating, which I mentioned, is largely from natural gas. So that's an obvious next step. Some of the other things that we include in our inventory are things like waste generation. So obviously waste going to a landfill creates a lot of methane, which is, you know, has a pretty large global warming potential. So waste is included, as well as some transportation. So faculty, staff commuting to work, our vehicles in our fleet, so, you know, driving things around and transporting them, all those kind of things count as well. And there's a lot of discussion in this realm about who counts what, but that's essentially what we're trying to do right now is, you know, inventory the things that we can well now, and then obviously the things that are more within our control, like heating our campus, try to take some action on. So I think that's where, you know, trying to adopt more renewables would make a huge difference. So I think I mentioned before we're about, our emissions are about half of what they were when we signed the commitment. So when we first took a greenhouse gas inventory in 2007, we have halved our emissions, which is pretty great. Mm-hmm. But that obviously means we have about halfway to go. Mm-hmm. So both a celebration of progress, but also work yet to be had ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think something that a lot of people don't realize is that in the plans for carbon neutrality, I think the number is 10 to 15% of it comes from individual behavior changes, which is both students, faculty, and staff. Mm. And that ranges from everything from like how students get to campus, whether they're driving or flying, and whether the college offsets that, and then down to like how much are we recycling? How much are we throwing away? Are people using power strips and turning them off? Like things that seem really small. And I think it gets back to that conversation of things that seem really small, but actually do matter in both. All of those things accumulated together can reduce our carbon emissions by 10 to 15%, which is a big number.
Yeah.
And also the fact that through all of those changes, people will care about carbon neutrality and care about like the sustainability of Oberlin.
And I think just even if people don't necessarily care about sustainability or environmentalism that much, I think most people care about efficiency just generally. Mm-hmm. If you're doing something and you see glaring errors, you want to remedy them. And so I think people just taking responsibility and making changes is really important. So part of what Rachel was talking about, the behavior change, so we actually started a lab that's now a class called Community-Based Social Marketing, so CBSM. So Professor Cindy France in psychology and I run what used to be a research lab and is now is a full course using the social psychology methodology of community-based social marketing. So it's essentially trying to use social psychology for behavior change around sustainability using proven methodology as opposed to just kind of guessing or like telling people what they should do, because some little things don't actually make a big change. So we don't want to be encouraging people to unplug their cell phone charger just because it's a green action they could be taking when it has almost no effect whatsoever. But, you know, changing your laptop settings or, you know, eating more vegetarian and vegan or trying to offset your flights or carpool or things like that that actually have a decent impact are more what we try to encourage people to do, as well as also things that not a lot of people are already doing. So like if 99% of people were turning off their lights already, we probably wouldn't remind everyone to turn off their lights. So we've tried to be, you know, effective in the messaging and be more strategic about how we want to communicate things to people.
Gotcha. Closing sort of towards the closing of this conversation. I think one of the things that we talk about a lot on our show is the current budgetary situation that Oberlin finds itself in, which is not really very fun to think about, personally. However, because it's more fun, we're not going to think about it. So the question is, if you had sort of, maybe not like the power to change the world, but if you had like a bucket of money to do something really, really cool and unique that could make a really, really, a really big impact in our sustainability efforts, what would it be?
Ooh, that's fun. I don't know that I've ever thought of that because, like I said, we are actually in the Finance and Administration Division, so we usually have to make at least some kind of economic argument for a business case.
I know what I'm
But
saying.
I think definitely pursuing the landfill gas waste heat because it just makes sense and is a renewable on top of a renewable and has the opportunity to serve the community. As well as, you know, neutralize or closer to it our carbon emissions from heating and get rid of or at least vastly reduce natural gas, which, as we've talked about, has some issues in our communities. So I think that, as well as personally, I think having way more and better access to vegan foods and plant-based foods, just because that also makes a really large difference. There's been some really cool research actually on like some of the most effective things that you can do, like management of refrigerants, educating women and girls, and to reduce population and increase kind of access to information, and increase plant-based foods are some of the more effective behaviors. So that's what I would focus on probably.
Well, being on the RCT, I see a lot of waste. And if I had unlimited money and resources, which is actually one of our interview questions for the RCTs, if you had unlimited money, what would you do? But my answer is I would work on getting Oberlin College to be a waste, zero waste campus, which is actually something that's being pursued at other schools, which I think is really interesting. I think there's a lot to do with that. I think a big part of that is just education and getting people to understand, like really understand recycling, even as it relates to where we are, because some people understand recycling at home, but recycling is different everywhere. So I think like getting new containers that are really clearly labeled and getting compostable retainers that actually look compostable rather than like plastic, and working more on food waste. And I just really would like to see the day when Oberlin doesn't throw anything away, because Everything can be upcycled if you use your mind.
Do we have a second to talk about recycling?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, goody. Okay.
tell us all about it.
Oh,
so we actually, so again, the optimism for next year is always high at the end of the semester when you think of all the things that could be better. And one of the things that we're going to work on over the summer is more strategically looking at our bins and bin placement mm-hmm. everywhere so that we can get new signs and better bins pretty much everywhere on campus. I think that will be really awesome. Mm-hmm. And I think as your kind of question before about like having a transient population, what Rachel just said is very true, that some people might come from a community where recycling happens differently and they don't really know here because maybe they were authority there, so they're not going to listen to what happens here because they knew what was recyclable mm-hmm. in their community. So I think there's a large opportunity to educate people as well as, again, trying to connect those issues to, like, there are physically people going through your recycling, which
yeah.
is also your trash in our community. Helps contextualize things a little bit for people. The first time I ever went to a recycling facility, I was like, my mind was uh-huh. blown because you just picture it because I wash my recyclables and they're all recyclable materials. I just pictured it being so clean and nice. And then, you know, you go to the recycling yeah. facility and they're like, oh yeah, people put their lawnmower blades in there and there's plastic bags everywhere and
loaded
trash.
Rifles at the one
no.
that Oberlin sends things to. Loaded
what?
Weapons. Recycling yeah. facility, if you can visit the one just down the road from here, one of the coolest places that I've been to whilst a student here.
Yeah, it's really... Well, and then there's, again, the kind of difference between a thing that we want to be great and it in practice
mm-hmm.
is we have a bunch of compostable materials, but not everywhere do we have composting. So those things, they look like plastic, but they're actually plant-based. So they actually should go in the trash. They should not go in recycling because they're meant to fall apart. That's the point of them being compostable. So they're not going to be able to be recycled. So a lot of people don't know that and they put the materials in, you know, their recycling thinking that they're doing a good thing because that's awesome. They're trying to do a good thing, but that's not actually the most appropriate place for it. So we're actually making a video that should be out very soon, so everyone get hyped for our awesome video that will hopefully shed some light on that subject.
Cool.
And then hopefully eventually we'll also have composting more places and better recycling. Mm-hmm. And also a note on the zero waste thing. So I helped write work with Oberlin for our zero waste plan. So Oberlin has a zero waste plan by 2050. So that means that Oberlin College will pretty much have to be zero waste by 2050.
That's
not
what
before.
I like to hear.
So.
All right. Well, on that positive note for the future, it looks like, unfortunately, we have run out of time. But thank you both so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Weekly, a co-production of WOBC and the Oberlin Review. The show is created, written, and produced by Daniel Marcus and me, Johan Kavert. As always, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts and Google Play by searching The Weekly Oberlin, and the show is also now available on Radio Public. You can also listen on the web at www.anchor.fm/the-weekly. Thanks for listening.